Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Triangulation is brought to you by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Triangulation, episode 91, recorded February 13th, 2013. James Bishara, Crowd Tilt. Triangulation is brought to you by Audible.com. To download the free audiobook of your choice, visit audiblepodcast.com/triangulation. It's time for Triangulation, the show where we get great minds on the show and talk about great things. Sometimes not so great things. Little things sometimes too. I am really pleased to welcome a new entrepreneur to our show today. A lot of times we get the old guys who've moved on. You know, they did their startups. Now they're just kind of advising others. In fact, that's how we met James Bishara. Alexis Ohanian, you may remember, creator of Reddit, was on. And he is one of the investors in James' new startup. James, welcome to Triangulation. Good to have you.
Yeah, thank you.
Is this your first startup? No, it's your second.
This is my second.
Yeah.
First startup in the States.
What was your other startup?
The first one, which was also a crowdfunding type of site, built it in Cape Town, South Africa.
And this one was the first one was a little more noble.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That is
now good. It's like party time.
Yeah, exactly.
So tell me about the first startup.
Sure. So the first crowdfunding startup that I built, I studied development economics. So
you were not a computer science major.
No, I wasn't. I picked up web development in college, but studied a very different type of development.
I'm wondering if this is going to be a trend. It used to be that all the entrepreneurs were computer science, you know, computer programmers, and that was kind of it. And I'm wondering now because the internet is so pervasive and computer tech. Everybody in your generation grew up with computers. That if maybe that's just kind of that's along for the ride. And so you're interested in developmental economics, mm-hmm. and you happen to be a programmer.
Yeah, so
it's like a second. That's like the second thing.
It's people have their day jobs and then they go home and they're great gamers. Hobbyists and things like that.
So you like to program as a kid? Or?
My first job ever actually was repairing computers. So the actual hardware side of things when I was 13, 14
years old. As a teenager, you were repairing computers. Mm-hmm. So you were a little focused on making a buck here or there.
Some
kids have paper routes. You were fixing computers.
Yeah, exactly. I just enjoyed it. And really enjoyed kind of just tinkering those.
And you had a knack for it.
And seemed to have a knack for it, but and took to web development in kind of a similar vein. It just it seemed natural, and really enjoyed tinkering, but on a different scale. And so I was working in Cape Town, South Africa, and I was building out a group fund. This was 2008, 2009, before mm-hmm. the term crowdfunding. And it was a site to allow people to group fund loans to developing communities.
Kind of like Kiva?
Yes, it was just like Kiva, but for micro insurance organizations.
Oh, insurance? Water,
mm-hmm, instead of microfinance.
Not finance.
Right. So it's a slight but important distinction within the development realm, the development
economics. In the developing world, is there even insurance?
It's... Within,
I mean, that seems like a first world thing.
Right. So did finance and so did loans and credit. But
I guess everybody can use insurance. It just seems,
absolutely.
Seems like a luxury a little bit.
That's the misnomer. That's the kind of the issue at hand is, you know, within the development realm, within kind of the poverty alleviation realm, microinsurance is seen as possibly being even more powerful, scalable
really?
Than microfinance.
Insuring just, what?
Insurance, things like livestock insurance,
right.
House and property insurance, life right. insurance, the insurance products that you and I kind of take for granted every day that ensure when your livestock is killed by disease that you don't have to yank your kids out of school and stunt that next generation by and today that's exactly what happens. The first thing that happens when your livestock is killed by disease or your crops are killed by a drought, the first thing that happens is the kids are pulled out of school.
Right.
And they're stunted
from it. It's a vicious cycle.
3 years, 4 years down the road, happens again, pull them out of school.
Right.
So insurance helps, and I don't want to get too in the weeds of development terms, but insurance helps what's called income smoothing.
It's a stabilizing force.
Right. And so because of its power, because of its something that I'm really passionate about, I started to build out this website.
That was right out of school?
That was right out of school. So 22. I started literally in my dorm room senior year and started building it out on the ground with partnerships with organizations.
It's cool because that's a really good example of the power of the web. Here you are in school. Where did you go to school? Virginia?
Wake Forest.
Wake Forest. So, basketball?
Yep.
Oh, did you play?
I went there to play basketball. But
did you really?
Actually,
I noticed you have some height on you.
Yeah, I know. But
that's cool.
I was injured. I broke my back. Couldn't play.
Oh, dear.
But it was a blessing. It was an absolute
you could focus on your studies.
Blessing.
Yeah.
I went there originally to play basketball walk-on,
cool.
So I wasn't going to be
cool.
a star player. But
that's
but
neat.
Ended up taking this.
So, but what I was starting to say is that really illustrates the power of the web, especially, I think, for your generation that grew up with it. You see it. You have an idea. You studied development economics, and you say, you know, what really needs to happen, and you can make it happen in your dorm room in a global way is remarkable.
Right.
Is that company still around? What happened?
No, it isn't. We wanted to really push the limits, and I convinced one of my high school friends to come join me and move over to South Africa. And the reason we were building it there is because we were building it in conjunction with the organization that I was working for, microfinance, microinsurance organization. And so I convinced him to come over. And as a founder, this is your nightmare. You convince all these people to drop what they're doing
and
come join.
Yes.
Come join on this on this revolution you're trying to start. And we really wanted to push the envelope. And at the time when we started, you could have interest-bearing loans advertised to the public online in the U.S. And in our 12th, 13th month of development, the SEC changed the legislation. And it really made our economic model, the way that they changed it, it was a pretty dark time in my life because we had spent so much. It was something I was so passionate about. But,
it must have been very frustrating.
And
the U.S. was the only reasonable place for you to get donors, investors?
You know, even though the organizations happen to be in Senegal, Vietnam, Nicaragua, Peru, and South Africa.
Such a good idea.
The general public.
The capital's all
the capital was in the U.S. Well, at least that's where we knew the capital was.
Right.
I'm sure it was in Europe as well, where they have much more relaxed views of online lending. But we really felt like the demographic user base was going to be in the U.S.
Is somebody building something now maybe that could be European-based?
Ironically, the Jobs Act makes it a little bit
That's
more palatable
right.
in the
we
U.S.
That's right.
Right.
The rules on investment have absolutely
they
changed.
They have changed. So, so maybe...
Must be a chance.
And I know. And how it becomes kind of bringing it back full circle is someone could build this off of the API we just released for Crowdsold. Last month, if they wanted to.
So you moved on. You have a new company, and you've paired up with a guy named Khalid Hussein.
Mm-hmm.
He wasn't the guy in South Africa.
No. This is
he's still there in South Africa. Just
he's my high school buddy. I left him there and said,
"See ya.
Make sure no one takes our servers. I'll be back when legislation changes." No,
this is a good lesson for. Being a startup and being entrepreneurial, you are constantly faced with challenges that are sometimes overwhelming.
It was it's funny. I was telling one of our investors a few weeks ago that at that point in time, after the first startup and after working for months and months and then having the carpet kind of ripped out from beneath us.
By something that's completely out of your control, the U.S. government.
I mean. And that's what really just made it sting so much is it kind of felt like, man, there's literally so little is in our control.
Yeah.
In the end, that's a very healthy viewpoint. But
why?
I can see
why it's devastating on the first glance.
In practice, when you slam a wall and realize it kind of cracks this notion you've had a pretty juvenile notion of control to begin with.
Right.
But
reality
once,
hits you in the smack dab in the face.
But once you kind of go into your entrepreneurial pursuit, knowing so many things are really out of your control, and you've kind of left that juvenile delusion behind, then you gear yourself up for, you know, any day at any time something can come along and rattle you a little bit, and that's okay because you're not really in control of everything.
Does it make you more flexible? What does it do?
I think it just tempers expectations.
Right.
I think it makes me and us so fortunate for every, you know, blessing that we've had along the way, or
right,
every day that we get to continue going on this route.
Right.
It just makes a little bit more appreciative. If you know that it's out of your control to begin with, you're a little more appreciative for the time you've got.
It's like being on a roller coaster. You just enjoy you shut up and enjoy
exactly
the ride. You don't
exactly
say, I don't want to go downhill.
No. Right.
That's it.
Exactly.
And that's where the ride's going.
And you don't know when it's gonna end, but once you kind of just say, okay, we're on the ride, you start to appreciate the time that you're actually on the ride and not waiting in line.
So your experience with Develo kind of got you into this idea of crowdsourcing finance.
Right.
Is that how you got the idea for CrowdTilt? Where did...
Yes. So
this is very different.
Not, right. It's,
yeah. But same, but different.
No, it's similar in the mechanics, but yeah, very different in scope or kind of approach. The to answer your question, it is where we started, where I started with the prototype of CrowdTilt. But Paul Graham from Y Combinator has this essay talking about developers not thinking big enough, not thinking broad enough.
I love Paul Graham. I read all his essays and his blog post, whenever you can. It's well worth reading.
He's,
brilliant guy.
He's a sage, you know, for people interested in startups. His essays are just so thoughtful, so well written. And one of his essays and really harps on the fact that, or his observation that, you know, his fear is he'll get a capable hacker, a smart, creative, passionate hacker that's working on a problem that's too small.
Little.
That's a little tiny problem.
Yeah.
And that resonated with me because I felt like we had built this site and software for what we thought was this grand, ambitious idea.
Seems like it, yeah.
Of develo.org. And we had built this site for what ended up being kind of a niche within a niche within a niche. Group funding loans online within international international development and for microinsurance.
So did you say to yourself, how can we think bigger?
Right. How can we kind of come back at this? And for 7 months, I kind of thought I was never going to start another thing.
Right.
Again, I was never going to... I was.
You came home from South Africa with your tail between your legs.
Right. I had spent...
we
had raised $35,000 from friends and family. We spent it. We had all these, you know, grand dreams and that we'd been selling to friends, family, and all these supporters, and came back.
Is that the hardest thing? Is going back, not merely bringing your high school friend to South Africa,
right,
but going back to family and friends and saying, "I lost the money's gone."
To professors that had put their kind of names.
Did they understand?
Absolutely. I think looking back,
they had a more practical point of view than you did, maybe.
And I think I was a little bit harder on myself just for.
Still, just that's embarrassing.
Right. And it was, and that's you know, what, ironically, sometimes it's the real base motivations that drive you. With CrowdTilt, too, it's this, we're from Texas, and we started in Austin, moved out for Y Combinator to California, and we don't want to go back and not have achieved our goals again.
We failed again.
Right. So it's almost healthy to recognize that pushes you. But so with CrowdTilt, the idea was, what if we just open this up for people to collaborate around
anything,
groups to collaborate around anything that has some financial.
It could be a party.
And that's where the use case and the users have really taken the site is, you know, there's a Kickstarter up in New York City, a phenomenal startup and site that allows you to pool money for, say, a $40,000 documentary. And people are using CrowdTilt today for, you know, a $1,400 party bus. they're very different use cases. But, or a $5,000 5K that you're going on a run for.
Well, that's good. Okay.
And a nonprofit fundraiser. Or it's a $150 tailgate for Saturday's big game. You know, it's
really what you have is an engine for gathering donations.
Right.
Whether it's a private thing where, like, I need to get 20 of my friends for this bus.
Right.
But it could be a public thing.
It could be a public thing. It could be, you know, a public and an ambitious thing. For New Year's 2 weeks ago, no, four weeks ago, a group used it for a 150-person private plane to Vegas. And so that was very
public.
Was
it open to the public?
Yes, yes. So they,
and if you bid, you would get a seat on the plane?
Right, so they basically just said,
we need to get 150.
Right, it was originally, I think, a 130-person plane, and it sold out within 2.5 hours, so they extended it to 150. But they basically said, wouldn't it be awesome for New Year's if we got a private plane to Las Vegas for this? You know, we'd get a suite and limos to take us to the suite, and it costs $65,000 to make it happen. Everyone pitching, you know, $350 or whatever it ended up costing, and everyone pitch in to make it happen in the first place. And that's very different. It's subtly, you know, it's similar to maybe Eventbrite or selling tickets, but it's. In truth, like in the actual, in practice, it's very different. It's everyone coming together to make it happen in the first place. It's not one person selling tickets to friends or
it's
one person organizing it.
Yeah.
It's everyone kind of collaborating around making it happen. And no one's charged unless that $66,000 is reached. And so the organizers don't have
this
risk.
It's very similar to Kickstarter or Indiegogo.
Yep.
But the focus is a little different.
Right. It's yeah. It's kind of this really accessible everyman's type of
fundraising.
Crowdfunding,
right.
Yeah, crowdfunding site.
Now, you got into Y Combinator, which is one of the earliest and best still startup schools. Mm-hmm. It's very exclusive, very hard to get into. And it's almost it's not a golden ticket, but it's a pretty good ticket to success, right? Tell me about that. Did you know you wanted to get into Y Combinator? Or?
No. We didn't know, and we actually applied, and I've heard this story from two or three other friends' startups, but we were on the cusp of not applying. We were down in Austin, Texas, and we felt like, man, let's be this young consumer startup. Groupon just did it in Chicago. Let's be this young consumer startup that really, you know, puts our stake in the ground in a non-Silicon Valley city, and really make it happen, be this phenomenon within Austin. You know, born and bred in Texas, you have a lot of pride for your
home state. Gowalla?
Yeah, Gowalla was there.
Gowalla,
and
yeah.
So we were like, okay, it can be done. Mm-hmm. They were just actually going through some troubles.
Right.
This was the end of 2011 and beginning of 2012, and they get acquired by Facebook, and that's when we kind of think, okay, if they're struggling with that, what if we're making it harder on ourselves by being in Austin? If they had these troubles of being away from Silicon Valley, an area that is, you know,
why give
it before,
up that advantage,
right,
if it is an advantage?
If it's 5% easier.
Yeah.
This is going to be hard enough, but if there's something that can make it 5% easier, let's pursue that.
You get a small investment from Y Combinator,
right.
But I don't think it's the cash, really, is
no,
it?
It's not the cash. So we, on the Sunday, the actual deadline to apply.
You waited till then?
We didn't. We are going through this thought process of feeling like, you know, we had this thought of, you know, Larry and Sergey, they didn't need an incubator,
right.
Incubator program. So, you know, we can do it, which was just startups are so tough. You got to take every advantage that you can get. But the day that it's that we need to apply the deadline, 2 hours before the deadline, we fill everything out. We do our 1 minute, 60-second video interview in this 123 square foot office that we were renting in Austin at the time, this closet of a space. Do the interview, send it in, and we didn't tell any. We were trying to raise a round of investment in Austin, so we didn't tell any investors because
right.
We didn't want any signal.
Because one of the requirements of Y Combinator is that you have to move to San Francisco.
Yep, exactly. And we didn't want on the other side. We didn't want them to know if we didn't get in,
right?
Because it's
right.
It's
That's
so competitive.
Yep.
And then a few weeks later, we realized we heard back that, you know, we're invited to the interview, and
That's
then
huge.
We go through the interview process.
That's huge.
And then we got in and had to make the decision. Of whether to do it or not, and decided to do it.
Do people turn them down? I guess they could. It seems unlikely.
I've never heard of it. I don't think I've ever heard of anyone turning
them down. So Paul obviously looked at CrowdTilt and said, that's big enough.
Yeah, he said, I like this.
You're not thinking small here.
Right. And he heard
But what
our,
is it different? What makes it different from from I mean, there's a lot of these. Kickstarter, mm-hmm. Indiegogo, they're best known. But what makes it different?
Ours is, if you think of it, kind of a spectrum of the public, so crowdfunding, which is typically for Kickstarter, where it's advertised for the general public, strangers.
You're wearing a Pebble watch.
Yeah, right? Exactly.
It's one of the big Kickstarter successes.
Right. In fact, I think the biggest.
And they're another. They're millions.
A Y Combinator company too. Right. And great guys. And we love Kickstarter. Kickstarter's, you know, we're such fans of what they built. Our view was, here is one end of the spectrum for the general public. A guy in Omaha can get money from a stranger in New York, Miami, Des Moines. And then there's, on the other end, and there's Indiegogo, and there's there's a few. There's, mm-hmm. you know, a dozen over on this end of the spectrum. We thought, what about on this end of the spectrum where it's taking these mechanics but providing them to the network you already have?
Kind of more private.
More private. For more kind of, this is...
More
this
personal.
This is Twitter. This is your broadcast to the world. And over here is Facebook. You have your network of friends. Now you just need a platform to aggregate this demand for a private plane to Las Vegas, for the party bus on Friday night, or for fantasy football coming up. So those kinds of more private types of objectives, where you already know the people, you know the demand is pretty much there. Now you just need a platform to aggregate it, to pool money to make it happen.
There are a lot of Fund My things.
Right.
There's gogetfunding.com.
Right.
So this is a hugely crowded space, and I'm sure Y Combinator doesn't want to see another Me Too product. So there's got to be something you're telling the Y Combinator folks that makes them think this is something special.
What is it? Well,
you're more public?
Yeah,
more private?
More private, and our growth has been pretty strong.
So you were already doing it before you applied.
We were.
You had some test cases.
Right. And our growth was...
what's the biggest funding? I like the plane. That's a great one.
Yeah, the plane was 60-something thousand in 2.5 hours. There was a school in... that's the best thing we can say about the site is it just works.
Right.
It works really well, and that's where our growth... the thing that we're telling Y Combinator, the thing that we tell investors, is we just show them the adoption of the site. You use it once and you want to use it again.
There's something, and it's so hard to quantify this, but great sites do have this magic where you just go, I like that experience. It was a great, there's something about it and I want to do it again. So
and
John Paul II Catholic High School needs to raise money.
This one, I think it was in about 9 days, $100,000. They needed $99,000 exactly for their school charter that they were going to lose.
So most of the people who donated probably know this.
They knew everyone, the moms, the parents, the dads, they knew each other.
So part of this is that you're really providing a back end. They're going to provide all the marketing. They're going to go out into their community and say, hey, we need to raise this money. Everybody knows, because if you're a student there, you know.
Right.
This is where we're going to send people, crowdtilt.com/whatever.
Exactly. Our biggest competitor isn't, you know, this crowded space on the public side of things. In the private side of things, where you know the 15 people or you know the 90 parents, you know, our biggest competitor is cash and checks. It's usually someone sending out an email and saying, hey, everybody, send a check. And that really, you know, as a product, we think about it in terms of how can you take what would be in the real world 150 people in a room and a hat placed in the center of the room and everyone clamoring to fund this objective that everyone wants to make happen. How can you take that and put that on the web? Today, because there are limitations in trying to get 150 people in a room together.
A lot of bridal gifts. Here's a great one.
Yes.
Parker and Kelly wanted a smoker, apparently. It's not cheap. And so their friends got together, used Crab Tilt to raise the money, quite a bit of money. Mm-hmm. You call it tilted when you make it, right?
Right. So it only charges the credit cards when it's tilted.
It tips over.
Exactly.
Money.
So, and that really hedges the risk that the organizer is taking and trying to collect. Because if you do the cash and checks route, the limitation is there. As soon as you get that third check or that fourth check, everyone's like, all right, it's going to happen. I sent my check and you've got 15 checks. Yeah, you need 90 more, but it's got to happen.
What
right?
do I do?
Right. And not only is that just a pain in the ass to send the checks, but it's it's a lot of burden to take on as the organizer. And with credit cards, with technology, you can make that a lot easier for people by saying, hey, we're only going to buy this grill. We're only going to be able to afford this charter for the next year if we reach 99,000, if we reach 300. We're only going to have this barbecue if we can get the live band at $500.
We're talking, this is interesting. James Bashara is with us. He is the founder of CrowdTilt. I have some questions. And you did something that's very interesting. You have an API.
Yes.
And I want to talk about that and how that's different in just a second on Triangulation. We'll give a chance for the chat room to ask their questions. Our show today brought to you by Audible.com. This is how we raise money. Go to Audible.com and get a free book. They'll be so happy. They'll say, here, have some money, Leo. Actually, you'll be happy too, because Audible is a great bookstore of audiobooks, over 100,000 titles. One of the reasons that we started advertising for Audible is because I've been a member since 2000 for 13 years. They saved my life when I had a commute. I had a 2-hour commute each way. Well, no, 2 hours total, but an hour each way every single day. And I was about to go nuts. And then I found Audible.com. And then I wanted the commute to be longer, to be honest with you. Sometimes I'd drive around the block to finish what I was listening to. Fiction, nonfiction, science fiction. Valentine's Day is coming. Maybe you want to read Love Junkie, a memoir. I don't know. I just picked that at random because of the title. There certainly is a lot of romance titles at Audible.com, but there's also plenty of science and technology books, New York Times bestsellers. And one of the great things is Audible, over the years since I became a member, has really become the place for publishers to release new books. Most new books nowadays have audio versions on Audible. I mean, that is really great. It means when a new book comes out, you can immediately go to audible.com and listen to it. Now, I want to invite you to try it. We're going to get you your first book free. So I understand. Maybe you're a little skeptical. Well, I like audiobooks. If you go to audiblepodcast.com/triangulation, that is a lot of letters, audiblepodcast.com/triangulation, you'll be signing up for the book a month subscription. They call it the gold plan. But your first month is free and your first book is free. You can cancel at any time. And the book is yours to keep forever. So, and that's one of the things I like about Audible.com. I have over 500 books in my Audible library. Using the Audible app on iPhone or Android or BlackBerry or Windows Phone, I can see all the books I've ever listened to on Audible, and I can download them and listen to them again, which is fantastic. Look, the Grammys. This is interesting. Oh, these are Grammy Award winning. Did you know audiobooks can win Grammy Awards? I didn't know this. Oh, Betty White narrating her biography, If You Ask Me. Now, that's a great book. That could be your first book free. Audiblepodcast.com/triangulation. You pick a book and make it yours. And I can't recommend this highly enough. Audiblepodcast.com/triangulation. Our guest is James Bashara. He's the founder. Are you CEO or president? Did you give yourself a title?
I am, I guess, CEO.
Chief Tilter?
Yeah, with how small of a company we are.
I know,
are.
It's so silly.
It is so silly.
How big are you now? You got you and Khalid.
Yeah, we're about 15.
15 people. And you've been around for a year?
How long? 8 months. So we launched in February of 2012 and then came out of beta in April.
And was Y Combinator all you had hoped it would be? Did you get a lot?
It was. It was. We lived a block from Paul Graham. PG is what you call him at Y Combinator. We lived a block from him. He took us under his wing. He really and really liked seeing how people were just using this site for these fun, crazy group experiences, group purchases, and so for us it was great. It's phenomenal.
And you make money by taking a fee.
Yes.
Similar to all these other crowdsourced.
Well, I think ours is the lowest fee. So 2.5% is our fee. I think that is the lowest. I think Indiegogo gets up to 9%.
Wow.
I believe, so.
So you only pay if your campaign tilts. So it's free to start a campaign. You go online. You do it at crowdtilt.com. Mm-hmm. If your campaign tilts, in other words, if you hit your goal, you take 2.5%, and the contributors, the people who pay money, pay a 2.5% credit card fee,
right?
Which is actually pretty low.
Mm-hmm.
That's great. And this is interesting. The average campaign on CrowdTilt raises 188% of its goal.
Yeah, it's that's one of the...
Because it's so friction-free.
Right, and that's actually a stat we got to do better at highlighting some of these stats. That's one of our favorite figures is these goals, or these campaigns, they reach almost twice their goal using CrowdTilt. So, you know, it's one of our... uphill battles of saying, hey, it's worth using instead of cash or checks. And it's worth paying this fee, a 2.5%.
Contributors just use their regular credit card.
Right.
You don't have to give a PayPal account or CrowdTilt.
No. So just a regular credit card. But one of the easiest ways to make that selling point is to say it's 2.5%, but you're going to raise, on average, twice your goal because of how easy it is while people are in their office, while they're on their phones, because you can use it on your phone or your tablet, everything. They can make a contribution right there. They don't have to write a check, mail it, put it in the post.
Right.
They don't have to wait to see you to give you cash. They don't have to, with PayPal and groups, you can send someone $20 on PayPal. You can send someone $50 on PayPal, but you don't see other people giving too. You don't kind of get that momentum of seeing all these people contribute towards it. So it's really powerful to drive the momentum.
And you could be a nonprofit, but you don't have to be a nonprofit.
Right. So we just, in November, we actually launched, and this was, dear to my heart.
As an economic development guy.
Right.
Yeah.
So we launched the ability to offer tax-deductible receipts automatically through the site.
Oh, that's great.
So not only can you use it for nonprofits, but we can automatically disperse the tax-deductible receipts for you and make the fundraisers for nonprofits completely tax-deductible at no extra charge. The other sites that offer this usually tack on an extra 4-4.5% just to do a tax deductible receipt.
So there seems to be, this is great by itself, but you must have dreams and goals of grander and grander things. What's next? What do you want to do next?
Well, we've got this very strong view that crowdfunding is bigger than just a site, bigger than just one silo or three silos or 12 silos that it exists in, or CrowdTilt and Kickstarter and Indiegogo. We feel like the entire web can really make use of this phenomenon.
That's why you have an API.
And yeah, so that's...
This is really interesting. The idea of an API is that somebody can use your back end,
right,
but create their own front end,
right, so
for it.
And we're all software developers. We're all pretty big geeks. And within the software development community, there's this big belief in this open community contributing towards others' goals. If you have accomplished something, why make someone else reinvent the wheel? We had built this complex billing system, this complex backend, this engine for CrowdTilt, and 11 other sites had built it. But we feel like in 7 years there's going to be a couple hundred, if not a couple thousands. So why not let others make use of this engine you've built? Especially with my co-founder, Caleb, who came from Rackspace. He's probably the single smartest hacker I know. The way that he built it, it was like everyone should be able to use
it. And it should scale. Basically, I would create a white label version of CrowdTilt. It wouldn't say CrowdTilt on it,
right?
You're doing the back end fulfillment and all of that stuff,
right? And it can go even beyond that. So you could build a mobile app for bill splitting at a dinner table.
Oh, using you guys,
using us.
And you take the 2.5%. That's fine. I got the app.
We actually only charge 1% for
the API. 1% for the API.
Yeah. So we take 1%. We host it for you. We scale it. It's there for you to use.
Here's an example, Lockatron.
Yep.
.com.
Mm-hmm.
So this is powered by CrowdTilt.
No, we actually partnered with him on this open source project called CrowdHoster.
It's a keyless entry using your phone.
But what we saw was Lockatron was building this. They had to build it from scratch.
Right.
And they didn't have our API. Our API hadn't launched yet.
Okay.
And we saw these really successful. So if you see there, they raised over $2.2 million.
Yeah.
They sold a lot of these.
They didn't use Kickstarter. They didn't use somebody else.
They had to build it from scratch. They're hardware guys building this amazing this amazing hardware product to unlock your doors, and they had to build this crowdfunding application from scratch. Spend weeks and weeks of their time and something that isn't their core competency, that right. isn't what they want to be doing, they want right. to sell their product, taking on this risk of a very complex, you know, billing system that if they are to make a, if they build it incorrectly, they could double charge or triple charge customers. There's a lot of risk in trying to get your hands dirty with payments when it's not your core competency. And so they're another Y Combinator company. So we got to reach out to them and say,
we could, you know, we could work together.
Yeah, this
here.
Is,
yeah.
You know, what if we released our engine for you? And so we built this this project called CrowdHoster with them, which was kind of a hit within the development community as
I
well.
I see Dalton Caldwell of app.net
yep.
With a quote. Do they use that for their...
No, so that's...
he had to build an engine too, right?
They had to build it from scratch. And so within about 6 weeks last year in August and September, we saw app.net and Lockatron rebuild their systems from scratch. And it was part of this hypothesis we had that crowdfunding was going to spill beyond just these silos of Kickstarter and CrowdTilt. And when we saw those two projects raise, you know, well over $2.5 million combined, we felt like, okay, this proves our hypothesis that this engine and this behavior, this phenomenon is going to be massive, and people shouldn't have to build these from scratch over and over again, especially because crowdfunding has nothing to do with what app.net does. It has nothing to do with what Lockatron does. But right now, it's kind of like building your blogging system in 1996. You've got to build it all from scratch, and then in 2001, you can use WordPress. And our view is very similar.
You know, weirdly enough, American Express and Twitter just did something yesterday that I'm still trying to wrap my head around. You can pay, buy stuff on Twitter using an American Express hashtag. You have to sign up, of course, to associate your account with your American Express card. Mm-hmm. Is that kind of thing going to get in your way, or is it a validation of your idea?
No, yeah. So we would love to harness that, and we,
because obviously American Express has to build a whole back end with Twitter for this, right?
Right, and a lot, American Express and Visa, they both have been really interested in this API. So it was the first crowdfunding API launched.
Interesting,
and.
That's
first
thinking
of
big.
Kind.
Now you're thinking big.
Right. It's
1% of all the transactions in the world.
So, yeah, and we think it can power maybe 10 to 15% of group transactions, collaborative
Very
transactions is what we call it. We feel like 7 years from now, 10 years from now, 30 years from now, there's going to be a lot of collaborative transactions online.
Right.
And maybe it makes up 10 to 15% of all commerce online, and we would love to push that forward and love to power that. Who knows what our pricing structure will be at that point, but really we're just interested in building something that we feel like should be built and should exist.
It's very interesting.
Right now, it's a very isolating experience. When you check out on Target.com, you're paying one price for one item from one vendor in the exact same way we did it in 1912,
right.
much less 2012.
Right, it's not so different, is
the
it?
The internet has helped with distribution, but not much else. And we feel like there's a lot of communication that could be going on, a lot more dynamic of a model that could be happening, where it's not just one price for one person from one vendor happening at one moment in time, like 100
well,
years
you're
ago.
You're not alone. Google, Apple, Amazon all think the same thing. They've mm-hmm. got the credit card, and they would love to be a centralized payment system mm-hmm. for everything else that you buy. Are they a little threatening to you?
We don't know. We talked to other.
They want to do this. I don't think they have that crowdsource idea.
Right. If we're able to continue building what we're building, maybe they'll
partner.
They'll partner. Yeah. I think. You know, it's one of those things that it's stronger when people are contributing together and making it better together. It's how WordPress is powered. Another Texas entrepreneur that's one of my favorite entrepreneurs, and I was just with him this morning, Matt Mullenweg from
Love
WordPress.
Matt. Love Matt.
Is this idea of, you know, you can power a lot of the web maybe just by building the brand yourself. But if you can open it up to where everyone can contribute, everyone can make it faster, better, stronger from around the world, you can build WordPress, which powers, what is it, like 70% of the web.
It's an API as well, right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
So that's That is our view is if we can help people collaborate around building this engine that helps people collaborate, it just becomes stronger.
How many people have used CrowdTilt to date? Do you know?
We actually don't release any numbers, specific numbers.
More people every day, though, I presume.
Yes, we do more people every day.
Boy, this is a really cool idea. We built the studio. We faced kind of the same thing, and we went to Kickstarter. They said, no, you know, right. You're a existing business. So we ended up we raised money for bricks. You might have seen them when you came in. Mm-hmm. We just did it ourselves. We sold bricks, and there was some company that does brick fulfillment. Mm-hmm. But it would have been a lot. It would have cost a lot less, and it would have done a lot better job had we just gone to CrowdTilt.
That's what. And
you ever do a legal defense fund?
We have, actually. if you guys are in need of that.
What are you laughing at? but I would have to say an amount, a final amount. Like, mm-hmm. We're going for a certain amount of money.
Right.
Can I change that as time goes by, cost goes up?
You can, actually. launching this week is the ability to have a target above your tilt. So it tilts, in this case, it could tilt at $5,000, but the goal is $150,000. And so that also brings in a new element to crowdfunding of, instead of this all-or-nothing model.
Right.
This goes into action at this amount. But we want everyone to know that we're still rallying for this larger amount.
So this API sounds like something new. You actually haven't. When did you?
We launched it just a few weeks ago.
That's exciting.
And it's in its beta, and we're about to come out of beta. And it's so one of the
I
other things.
I expect to see a lot of people doing this.
It's one of the things we haven't even touched on is a little bit with Target, but is the ability to plug in the API into an existing brand. So instead of white labeling a dinner splitting app on your phone and a developer in Indiana building it, you can plug it into a vacation rental site to where six people can pay together on that site. For the house. The 13 people that are going to Tahoe on their ski vacation rental, they can go 100% of the way on the vacation rental site instead of going 50% of the way and then going on to CrowdTilt and having to split that experience.
I think that's brilliant.
So, yeah, we're excited.
I like this.
We'll be coming out with a cool announcement pretty soon.
James, it's been great meeting you, and I think this sounds like a wonderful idea. CrowdTilt.com. And do you turn people down? Do they have to get approved, or can anybody just?
No, so yeah. Contrary to the Kickstarter models,
they have to approve you. Yeah.
Right, they've got to approve you. You've got to submit an application and wait to hear back. No, ours is get up and going, and you can use it for anything. It doesn't have to be a specific use case.
And you get a short URL, and you could tie it into Facebook.
Absolutely, yeah. It's plugged in and fully integrated with Facebook, LinkedIn. Everything.
Well, we'll let you know when we start our campaign.
Please do.
I love this idea. CrowdTilt.com. It's so nice to meet you, James Bashara.
Appreciate you
coming up.
Thank you, Lou. Thank you for having me.
This is great. Yeah. We do triangulation every Wednesday afternoon, right after This Week in Google, usually about 3 p.m. Pacific, 6 p.m. Eastern time. That would be 2300 or midnight. I don't know. Add 8. So 2300 UTC on twit.tv. If you can't watch live, I love it when you watch live because I pay attention to the chat room. Kingy wants to know, is it okay to use this for illegal purposes? I need to buy a pound of hash. Can I get 20 of my friends involved in that? How do you stop something like that?
I'm sorry. I was so taken in by the feed.
We'll save that for another day.
I was so taken in by the feed over here.
You see this going all the time.
Yeah, this is great.
That's why we like the live audience. But if you can't watch live, you can get on on-demand audio.
Terrible ADD. If I see
don't
a screen,
worry about it. Pay attention. That's right. Yeah. It's you better off. Audio or video on demand after the fact at twit.tv/TRI or wherever you find internet programming like iTunes and so forth. Thanks for joining us. We'll see you next time on Triangulation.